Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is an award-winning independent documentary film director, writer, producer, who has written, directed, and produced series and documentaries for CBS, PBS, ABC, the Discovery Channel, and the PBS primetime special, The Music Instinct. She has worked with Diane Sawyer, Bill Moyers, and Peter Jennings. Looking for companionship after a near-fatal car crash, Elena Manis decided to get her first dog, who quickly showed her he had a mind of his own. Her book, Soul Dog, is a journey into the spiritual life of animals.
Tell us, what provoked you to get a dog? So what I'd like for you to do, if you don't mind, is to read from your book that point in your life that you realized you had to change something.
Yes, of course. This is the section that really talks about that. It was a point in my life that called for honesty. I could not evade looking at my situation. A long-standing relationship with a man had ended badly. He said I was his soulmate, and now he was marrying someone else. Whom could I trust? I had no prospect by this time of having children. My father died young when I was in college. My mother, nearing 90, was in a nursing home, becoming more mentally distant every day. When I looked at the world, I saw other people in relationships with someone. I walked alone. I didn't want to walk alone anymore. There'd been a trigger for this self-confrontation. A few months before, I was jolted into the realization that there should be more to my life than work. I was in a serious car accident during a film shoot in Nevada. The SUV rolled over 3 times on a dirt road. It was like being tumbled in a wave, but the wave was all metal, sharp parts and crashing. I had a seatbelt on, and I luckily survived with only a concussion. But any assumptions that I had plenty of time to change my life had literally been knocked out of me. Afterward, I wanted to feel connected to something.
This is my guest, Elena Manis, and she's reading from her book, Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. Now, this seems like a contradiction in the person that you were when you started out, before you met this dog. You wouldn't have been investigating the spiritual life of animals.
And absolutely not. I really say that I'm the last person in the world I would have expected to write this book or to have had this experience with my dog. It really transformed my life, the relationship that I came to have with my dog named Brio. And I was a big skeptic about anything like this, you know, what we call the woo-woo world. I was trained as a journalist, a television journalist, and not to accept anything that wasn't really established and proven by multiple sources and empirical fact. And, you know, I was not ready to believe in interspecies communication, especially through telepathy, which is what I came to investigate and ultimately to believe in.
Well, you describe the kind of person you were before you got Brio, and it's not very flattering, Elena. You don't flatter yourself when you describe the kind of person you were and the kind of personality people thought you had, your exterior personality.
No, that's true. I was, you know, a typical type A television producer, you know, very driven by ambition and doing a good job, and I was not always easy on people, to say the least. You know, I had very high standards, both for myself and for others, and I was not easy to work with, and I didn't communicate well in a personal sense with people, I don't think, often. I mean, there were exceptions, but it was very hard for me to be open with people because I didn't really trust many people. I was rather closed down in terms of being open about my emotions, I would say.
Well, you say I had a reputation for toughness in my professional life and coldness personally. And you say that you were demanding of yourself and people that work with you. You lacked patience. You lacked tact. You brooked no foolishness. And you say I didn't deal with people very well. I didn't communicate very well. So then all of a sudden you're going to be communicating with a dog?
Yes, I was very unprepared. And I, at the time, I certainly did not realize how unprepared I was. I mean, I got a dog, decided to get a dog in the midst of this sort of crisis I was going through, as I said, for companionship and the unconditional love that one hears that dogs offer, which indeed they do. But I really thought of it as a master pet relationship, that the dog would be totally under my control and I would get trainers and, you know, they would train the dog and everything would be very smooth and it wouldn't really change my life much at all, which certainly proved not to be true. The puppy was quite independent-minded, and with a very strong spirit, and he didn't always listen to me, and I started to become very frustrated. I thought he really didn't like me, maybe projecting on reactions I got from people in my life, I don't know. But, you know, I was becoming very frustrated and almost despairing about the situation.
Well, you say when you wanted to learn the language of dog that your goal was to be in charge, because that's where you were at your work. You were the person in charge, and that's what you expected. You say that your relationship with this dog, you were going to be in charge.
Well, absolutely. That's what I expected, and that's what I wanted. But then, you know, we'd be walking down the street, and he would be trotting ahead, sort of pulling me down the street, and people would say, who's walking whom here? You know, it was sort of humiliating. And then there was, you know, an incident in the park that sort of captured the situation early in the relationship. He had a tendency not to come back when I called, which was not only dangerous, but really very, very frustrating to me. So one day I was walking backwards, screaming at him to come to me. He'd run off again. And all of a sudden I realized that there was no ground underneath my feet. And I'd stepped backwards into a boat pond. It wasn't very deep, thank God. But it was very embarrassing, to say the least. Somebody I knew noticed it and said to me, oh, my God, that was you. I thought that it was a homeless person taking a bath. So I was dripping wet and finally gathered up my dog. And, you know, but this sort of thing was going on all the time. So, you know, I wanted to figure out some way to communicate with him, to understand what was going on in his head. So that was really what started me down the path of investigating, communicating with dogs and other species, particularly through people who call themselves animal communicators, animal psychics.
My guest is Elena Manis, and she has written a book, Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. Now, you just mentioned wanting to get in touch with animal psychics. And when you, a serious TV documentary producer, say you want to get in touch with a psychic, my thought was, oh my goodness, what about her professional reputation? And that's why I noticed that one of your blurbs in the front of your book, the person says, this brave author. And in fact, that's what I thought. You're pretty brave to put yourself out there like this, Elena. Did you get any reaction to your colleagues who say, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm getting it now. I mean, I didn't put it out there really in the beginning for many, many years, actually, for that very reason. I really was worried about the pushback I was going to get, how it would affect my career. I mean, I did do some stories for the network I was working for, which included animal telepathy, but I did it sort of under the guise of, oh, this is going to be fun, people are interested in it. I didn't really reveal that I myself was becoming kind of a believer, or at least open to it.
Well, at one point in your book, you say, when dogs speak and people listen, people change their lives. And I really came to understand dogs better as an adult. I mean, I grew up with dogs around. My brothers had dogs. But it wasn't until an adult and I had my own dog that I realized, yeah, you listen to dogs. Because that didn't occur to me. I thought it was a one-way conversation. I did all the talking. I told them what to do. And then I was surprised to find, oh, there's something worth listening to here. So perhaps your book will help people to understand, well, maybe I should listen.
Well, Well, that's my hope. I mean, that's the big reason why I wrote the book, because I was so changed by this whole experience. And I came into it as you did. You know, I loved animals, but really, you know, in my family, they were, you know, we consider them pets. And mm-hmm. as you said, you know, under the control of we humans, and I didn't really view them as, you know, equals, at least. And now I believe that they're at least our equals and often superior to us in some ways, and certainly our teachers, that if we do open up to really listening to what they have to tell us, it's transformative, really.
Well, I was interested in how you described yourself as a child, because you seem to be softer. You said when you were growing up, you had a Siamese cat in your household, and you said that you felt a kind of self-isolation because you had good friends when you were a kid, but you never shared your deepest fears and private thoughts with these friends. In fact, you said my most intimate connections with living beings were with animals. This is when you were a kid.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Said the animals were your salvation, this Siamese cat. You said when I felt I couldn't talk to anyone else, or when I went to bed at night, sometimes alone in the house with a babysitter when my parents were out, it was the cat who was my confidant and comforter.
That's absolutely true. As a young child, I think before professional, you know, considerations and, you know, all the tough facts of life that turn us into maybe something different from what we were as children. I mean, I was connected to animals. That's absolutely true. And I wouldn't say I ever really lost that, but it's certainly I lost that ability, I guess, or interest in really opening up to animals in the way I did as a child.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll have more questions for my guest, TV journalist Elena Manis, author of Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, documentary director and producer Elena Manis. You tell us what brio means in Italian, so remind us what brio means, Elena.
Yes, brio is a term used in music. My family were musicians, and brio means with energy and gusto, con brio. You see it written into musical scores. So I had heard the term, and when I settled on taking this boy puppy, he was very energetic, but I can't quite remember if I had sort of picked the name when I knew I was getting a boy, but I did pick it before I really knew him, but it turned out to be a very, very appropriate name.
Well, how did you meet Brio?
Well, I had seen a dog up in the country and investigated who the breeder was, and I called up, and it turned out she had a litter, so I went to see it when the puppies were very little, and there were, you know, obviously several puppies, and the puppy that turned out to be Brio made himself known immediately, although I didn't quite appreciate what was going on at the time. But he was the most active one. I mean, he kept running up to me and kind of waving his paw. And I decided, well, this is going to be much too much for me, you know, that I couldn't handle such an energetic boy puppy. And I lived in the city, and I'd heard females were easier to handle in the city, so I decided to take one, his sister. But then the co-breeder ended up taking the girl because, as fate would have it, Brio had a minor defect, nothing serious, but not good for breeding. So she took the girl, and the last puppy left was the feisty boy who became Brio. So I took him.
And this, you did not have the support of your friends, because your friends thought, oh my gosh, Elena, don't do it. You don't understand. A dog takes time and commitment, and you don't have that. And so your friends thought you were crazy.
They did. I mean, everybody thought I was crazy, pretty much. You know, like, how was I going to do this? And it wasn't fair to the dog, and I was traveling and working, and, you know, plus knowing me, they thought, you know, they probably doubted that I was really going to be able to connect with the dog, which made it even worse when I couldn't connect in the beginning. I mean, I was feeling incredibly upset that they had proved correct that this was not working out. So...
And you say that this puppy didn't need me. He was his own person.
He was from the very beginning. Nothing fazed him. He was incredibly confident. He, you know, just had a mind and a spirit of his own. But, you know, I came to really see that it wasn't just that he was being disobedient. He was just fully his own being. And, you know, he had a wisdom, you know, underneath all that, not so underneath, but I mean, he just had a knowledge about the world and that, you know, his place in it and who he was. You know, he never doubted who he was. I mean, he was totally comfortable in his own skin. And, you know, that in itself was a lesson to me. I mean, I saw what that was like, and, you know, I wanted to become more like that.
Well, what you're experiencing sounds very unscientific, Elena, but you mention in your book that in the 19th century, you mentioned Charles Darwin and this field of animal mind research. What did Charles Darwin think?
Well, he thought that animals, non-human animals, were, you know, feeling sentient intelligent beings. And he was one of the first to really to write about that and state a view of non-human animals is, you know, as I said, not inferiors, but unique beings in their own right, which I had not known. I mean, I found that fascinating.
Well, you have this puppy, and he's raising all sorts of questions about the relationship of humans and animals. So what did you do then? How did you explore this?
Well, I made that initial call to an animal psychic, somebody in California. I was on the East Coast. So she'd never met me, she'd never obviously met Brio. I didn't tell her anything except his name and his breed, and she ended up giving an incredibly accurate report or reading over the phone, describing my apartment from his point of view and, you know, how he navigated through the furniture, what streets he liked to walk on in the neighborhood, things about me that were pretty accurate, his personality that was accurate. So this was the first psychic reading I'd had. So, you know, I couldn't say that I was converted at that point, but I was definitely more curious because I couldn't explain how she could have known all that. There was no reasonable explanation for how she could have known all the things she said.
My guest is Elena Manis, and she has experience as a documentary filmmaker for major television networks, and she has written a book, Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. And in your work, you have colleagues like Diane Sawyer, and you think, what about getting a dog psychic to read Diane Sawyer's dog?
Well, again, very interesting. So I was doing a story on animal intelligence, a documentary, and I decided that I would do part of that on animal communication, telepathic communication with animals to further my own personal research. So I flew the animal psychic from California, who had first called Fabria, to the East Coast, and she had never met Diane's dog or Diane, or I certainly had no knowledge of the dog. And she met the dog in a hotel room and took it into a separate room away from us and came back quite a while later and again gave what appeared to me to be very detailed information. I mean, he wasn't my dog, so I couldn't personally attest to it, but one of the things the psychic said was that the dog had had a traumatic experience, that he was nervous, and he remembered feeling dizzy and spinning. And Diane said that he had, in fact, fallen into a swimming pool when he was a puppy. So that was pretty validating. And then the other thing we did was film the dog without the psychic. The psychic was not there. We filmed the dog at Diane's home and running around the yard and in the house, and then interviewed the psychic again and asked her to describe what the dog did in the house and the yard. And she did, again, incredibly accurately. I mean, we played the video against it, and it was precisely accurate, down to, you know, he went among the trees, he went next to a stream, where he went in the house. So that was pretty validating.
Well, I'm guessing that Diane Sawyer, in the position that she's in, has to be somewhat of a skeptic. She has to be doubtful. And how did she react to this information that you presented her with?
Well, I think in her position, you know, certainly I would imagine she was a skeptic. I think she felt that the story was interesting. She never expressed an opinion to me, really, about, you know, in a personal sense of, you know, what she thought about all this. But, you know, I never really went public at that point about what I thought about this whole thing, and she didn't either, obviously, for the same reasons, I'm sure. So, but she probably was even more skeptical than I was at that point, I would imagine. But we reported it accurately. She never argued about reporting what the psychic had said and how accurate it was.
Well, you had a record of the whole thing, right?
Right.
So it's hard to argue with that. You, at one point, take Brio to an Ayurvedic doctor, and this is Dr. Naram, and he tells you something that probably, at that point, maybe you knew Brio well enough to suspect that maybe this guy's telling the truth, but it's pretty shocking. What did he tell you about Brio?
Well, we walked in, and I was there for myself, for to get diet advice, but he took one look at Brio, who I'd just brought along because it was convenient that day. He takes one look at Brio and says, oh my goodness, he's an old soul. You know, and he spent much of the rest of the appointment focusing on Brio. And, you know, then he said, he's not coming back as a dog, that's for sure. Then he said, you'll be surprised. I mean, I still don't know really what he meant, but, you know, it was surprising. I mean, I did feel that he was telling a truth about Brio, because other friends by this time tended to notice there was something kind of special about Brio. Another friend of mine said, you can look into his eyes and see the pyramids. So I was becoming used to other people confirming my sense of Brio's spirit and his energy, his presence, as I like to say. There was just something about him that held you in its grasp. I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, you mentioned the night that your mother died in a nursing home and you took Brio with you. And what was that experience like?
Well, it was, you know, thank God he was there. I mean, he was very, I mean, he behaved, you know, as a human would. I guess he was very calm. You know, he just sat there with me by my mother's bedside after she had passed and really never moved. I mean, just sat there beside me. And, you know, it was such a comfort to have his presence, that he wasn't upset, he wasn't bothered, he wasn't fussing. And, you know, he calmed me and he allowed me to be in that moment with my mother.
Well, you describe that as an example of how you felt safe with Brio. You felt able to stay in the moment,
right,
and secure in the moment. You said even in very difficult situations. And that ability to stay in the moment sounds so simple. But I think typically we as a culture have so much difficulty with staying in the moment.
Oh, we do. I mean, and personally, you know, I certainly did very much in the past, you know, I still do sometimes, but I think I'm better due to this experience with Bria. But, you know, his presence really calmed me and centered me because he was so calm and centered. I mean, as I say, he just held the space. And, you know, he allowed me to sit in it with him.
And it helped that other people were starting to validate what you were feeling yourself. This. Now, there was a story that I thought was actually funny, Elena, and that was another time you decided, oh, I'll make a documentary about a horse and a woman who can communicate with horses. And what was the, how did you get that idea, Elena?
Well, frankly, I don't remember how I got the idea, but I was in the midst of, you know, sort of investigating this whole phenomenon of just psychic communication with animals. And so I persuaded the network to let me do a story to take an animal psychic out to Belmont Racetrack the day before the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes, which is the third leg of the Triple Crown. And so they decided I could do that, but and I got a psychic. And the only trainer who would let me do this was the trainer of the longest shot in Belmont history. Not just that day, that year, but in history, 70 to 1.
70. So, I'm just going to repeat that, 70 to 1.
Yes. So, you know, I really was not too happy about this, but I didn't have any choice. So we go out the day before the race, and the horse's name was Saraba. So we meet his trainer, and he took us to meet Saraba. And so the psychic, Saraba was munching hay, and the animal psychic, who I came to absolutely adore and trust absolutely, but at the time I was still somewhat skeptical. So she's standing there just looking at Saraba, presumably listening to him or feeling him somehow. And, you know, a lot of silence went by, and I'm thinking, oh, my word.
Really thrilling TV, huh?
Good television, you know, what am I going to do with this? So finally, she announces, he says he's going to win. So everybody's jaw kind of dropped. The trainer, especially.
I could see eyes rolling when she said that.
You know, he said, why does he say he's going to win? So the psychic says, well, he's sure he can do it. He wants to do it for you and his owner. So, you know, at that point, we finished the filming, and, you know, I'm thinking, you know, what am I going to do with this story?
It went nowhere.
The camera crew thinks I'm crazy. And so, you know, we headed home, and then fast forward to the next day, then I'm at home watching the race on TV, and this was the year that a famous horse called War Emblem had won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, and he was supposed to win the Belmont and win the Triple Crown. So the race starts, and then, of course, all the attention is on where War Emblem is and what he's doing, and the announcer really didn't mention Saraba at all until they got to the far turn, at which point I hear the announcer say, Saraba is moving up. And then he starts screaming, and he says, Saraba is overtaking War Emblem. And then, you know, he's really, you can hear the shock in his voice. You can watch this video on YouTube instantly. So he's screaming, Saraba has pulled ahead, and then Saraba has won. He's won the Belmont.
Yeah, you know, as I'm reading your story, I thought, well, it's got to be he's actually this horse with 70 to 1 odds is actually going to win this race. I'll bet that's why Elena's telling this story. And so I was, to some degree, surprised, but then I thought, yeah, that's the perfect happy ending to that story.
I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, I was stunned, of course, sitting at home. And then a few minutes passed, and I called the psychic, Dawn, and she didn't sound surprised, but, you know, she actually said that she was in tears when he had won because she was so moved for, you know, that the horse really was so proud of himself that he had done this for his owner and his trainer. I mean, it's so touching, you know.
It really is. And I love that story in your book. Now, moving on to a story that's not as much fun, if I want to use that word, is suddenly Brio could not walk.
Right. I mean, he was only around 8 years old, and one day he just collapsed on the sidewalk and couldn't move.
And this is a dog that loved to run. He loved to run. I mean, he lived up to his name.
Yes, he did. I mean, he just adored running, you know. And, you know, of course, I was devastated. And I, of course, rushed him to the vet. And, you know, there followed, like, weeks of test after test. And they finally diagnosed him with a degenerative neurological disorder. And the verdict was that he probably would never walk normally again, much less run. So, you know, I'm just, you know, devastated. And I decided, you know, to ask a friend of mine, well, I forgot how I found out, because this was not a person I even knew worked with animal communicators. But I mentioned Brio's situation, that's how it happened. And he suggested this animal communicator who did long-distance energy work, also healing. So I thought, what do I have to lose? You know, I'd already done all the Western medicine tests. So I call her up, and she connects, I guess, with Brio over the phone, and finally says there's nothing wrong with his spine, and I'm going to work with him today and two or three more times, but you're going to have your dog back. He's going to be able to walk and run. And sure enough, he did. And we had many more active years together, which was, you know, I mean, it's still somewhat amazing to me that she could do that, you know, having never met me or the dog over a telephone.
It goes against our understanding of science, Elena.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't explain this or telepathic readings in terms of our, you know, human senses. You know, the explanations for this lie in another dimension, which is the world of the invisible. And for somebody like me, who is used to having hard materialistic evidence, you know, to come to the knowledge that this actually was working, it, even if I couldn't explain it, I couldn't deny that it was working. So I became a believer.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with TV documentary director, writer, producer, Elena Manis, about her relationship with her poodle, Brio. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is TV journalist Elena Manis, author of Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. And it's about her relationship with a very special poodle, Brio. I can see why this then would lead you to think, okay, well, what does science? Can we prove this scientifically? And so off you go to see what science has to say. And how did you go about that, Elena?
Well, I started, you know, researching online, et cetera, and, you know, talking to people. And I talked to both people who had done studies, or still are, there are many coming out, about animal intelligence, cognition, and animal emotion, and found that the accumulating evidence now that dogs and other non-human animals are more like humans than we had expected in terms of how they respond to emotional triggers, for example, and how their brains are activated by certain things. There's fascinating neuroscience, brain imaging that proves this. For example, one neuroscientist, inspired by his own dog who had passed away, and he wondered if his dog had loved him for himself or because he gave the dog food. So he did brain scans comparing dogs' reaction to food rewards as opposed to human praise and connection, and found that at the very least, the emotional response in the brain was at least as strong for human praise and interaction as it was for food, and often stronger. So, and that's just a fun test, I thought.
Well, we did that. And I think dog lovers would not be at all surprised with that result, Elena.
That's true.
The brain would, that the dog is just as happy that he doesn't stay with his master and be loyal to this human being because this human being feeds him, but for emotional reasons. In fact, you say, like humans, dogs' brains separate speech into two parts. There are emotional cues as well as word meanings. And we human beings are pretty literal. We say this word means this. But dogs also look at the emotion behind the words. And yes, that's the two things that they are paying attention to.
That's right. We're very wedded to verbal language and verbal cues, but dogs obviously are less so, and they don't speak English. However, I mean, the other aspect of that is that, you know, it seems that dogs can learn our language to a greater degree than we had thought. For example, there's a famous border collie named Chaser who learned to identify over 1,000 objects by name, and, you know, the evidence showed that she really, you know, understood that what she was doing, that, you know, red ball, for example, that it was actually the red ball and not just a combination of two random words.
In fact, there's been, this dog has been on TV. They've shown video of this dog being able to do that. And you mentioned the red ball because the general wisdom, if they want to call that word, is that dogs are colorblind.
Right, but they've since found that there's another study I looked into, that they're actually not totally colorblind. I was curious because one of the animal communicators I used told me a story that she was reading a dog who had become sick in the stomach, and she got an image from the dog of a food bag, which I think was purple. You know, so when I heard this, I thought, oh, but how can dogs see purple? But anyway, it turned out that she followed the lead of the dog, the purple food bag, and then another lead that he showed that there was rat poison in it. That she, you know, there was, the dog told her there was some poison in it, and then she was able to connect to, you know, where the food had come from, that there actually was poison, and tell the owners, and the dog survived. So anyway, that's how I came to investigate the issue of color blindness.
Yeah, in fact, that dog ended up saving his own life because he could see color. There are a lot of quotes in your book that I liked, Elena, and one that I thought you might get around to, one of my favorite quotes, is by Nikola Tesla. And he says, if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. And these are invisible. So how did you notice that you came around to thinking in these terms as opposed to the concrete, literal world, that you begin to think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I truly believe that, you know, that's basically what's happening with telepathic communication. Of course, I'm helped along by a scientist who you may have heard of, Rupert Sheldrake.
Oh, yes, I love him.
Cambridge University-trained biologist in England who has studied the phenomenon of extrasensory perception and telepathic communication in our fellow animals, done fascinating studies and really accumulated pretty hard evidence of you know, this is a phenomenon. And he, his theory says is that a dog, for example, who seems to know when his or her owner is coming home and they wait by the door or the window, even when the owner's coming at random times, that he's bonded to the his human. And because of this bond between two beings, whether it be of the same species or different species, creates an invisible field that Childrick calls morphogenetic fields. It's a term that comes from evolutionary biology. But this is what he believes is happening. You know, we've all heard these stories of dogs traveling over incredibly long distances to find their people or to get home. And then, of course, within a species, there are, you know, the examples of homing pigeons who can find their way home. So this concept of invisible fields of vibration or frequency makes great sense to me. I'm not a scientist, but it certainly makes a great deal of sense to me.
My guest is Elena Manis, and she has written a book about her relationship with her dog, Brio. The title of the book is Soul Dog, A Journey into the Spiritual Life of Animals. And in your book, you say dogs do have souls. And that was, when you make statements like that, Elena, that's when I think, yep, she is brave to just come right out and say dogs do have souls.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a statement that I wouldn't have made before this experience. But first of all, dogs do have consciousness. Even scientists now believe and have stated that dogs have consciousness or awareness. All this terminology is a bit tricky. But in 2012, a group of international scientists, including neurologists, neuroscientists, came out with the Cambridge Declaration of Consciousness, stating that the neural substrates, to use their term, you know, indicates or gives strong evidence, I'm paraphrasing, that non-human animals do have consciousness or awareness, and that the quality of consciousness is not unique to humans, as had previously been thought by many, particularly in the scientific world. So if dogs and other animals have consciousness, to me, that's related to the idea that, you know, they have spirit or soul. I mean, these are not scientific terms, but, you know, I have no doubt that Brio had his own unique spirit and that he was somehow connected to something bigger than himself. And to me, that's soul, you know, something within ourselves, that presence that he had, that, you know, is connected to another dimension that comes from another dimension even. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I use the term soul because I believe in something that is soul. I think language doesn't really allow us to be too precise at this point, but it's not a matter of verbal human language. It's something we can't comprehend really in human terms. I think we comprehend it with our own inner beings or souls, if you want to use that term.
Well, I think you deserve credit for paying attention to Brio because he was teaching you. And for example, the first lesson you say you learned from your dog was about the power of letting go and surrendering to the flow of the universe. And I think that's hard for a lot of people in our culture, for example, to let go and surrender to the flow of the universe. I mean, we want to be in control, Elena.
We do. I mean, I can't say that I've totally surrendered to this day, but I certainly am further along that road than I was before my experience with Brio. You know, for example, you know, he was, you know, became physically debilitated in his last years and when he was ill. I mean, he never seemed to complain. He just dealt with it and, you know, enjoyed what he did enjoy, you know, eating and lying in the sun. And, you know, that's going with the flow. And there's a lot we can learn from a dog in that way. Not perfect, but.
Well, since you bring this up, a lot of us feel that the only problem with dogs is that they don't live long enough. We outlive the dog. So we know when we're reading your book, the day is going to come when you have to say goodbye to Brio. At least we think you're saying goodbye to Brio. How did that come about?
Well, that was the biggest gift of all, I think, from this relationship, that I learned that it wasn't saying goodbye, that after he passed physically, the connection was not broken. And the messages from Brio continued to come initially through the animal communicators, saying he did that support, but they gave incredibly accurate readings that I really believe were, you know, partially to prove to me that Brio was really with me in spirit. There were descriptions of where he was in my house, things the communicators could not have known. They'd never seen my house. I never described it. I wasn't even thinking of it, down to where Brio was sitting next to a particular wood trim or something like that. Descriptions of what I had been doing the day before with incredible detail in terms of where I was, what I ate, a smoky fire in a restaurant, things I certainly never talked about to the communicator. I wasn't even thinking about it when I was talking. So, and they were clearly, from Brio's point of view, there's no way that either the animal communicators, that they couldn't have known what I was thinking or feeling. Because I never gave away much when I asked for a reading. I wanted to hear what they came up with from Brio. So this experience really showed me that there is another dimension that lies beyond our physical senses in this invisible realm.
Well, there's a quote in your book that I like, and you're saying that what animals have to say, for example, what Brio taught you, Leonardo da Vinci, you quote him, "Man has great power of speech, but what he says is mostly vain and false. Animals have little, but what they say is useful and true." And you found that to be the case, that what Brio had to tell you was useful and true, in Da Vinci's words. And you say that one thing you will never forget, and that is Brio's gaze. Describe that gaze.
Oh, I try in the book. It had a depth and a kindness and a wisdom I looked into his eyes, and as I said earlier in our conversation, made me just, it recognized, I knew he recognized me, number one. He knew me, and he loved me. And that kind of recognition of who we really are is, now that's what we seek, I think, in relationships. But beyond that, I mean, his gaze, I mean, it saw beyond this earthly world. I really think that. I mean, he just had some sense of and larger knowledge that went beyond the day-to-day and materialism. And he always was in contact with that world. And that, you could see that in his eyes.
Yeah, in fact, you say that gaze is the look I call when I'm in trouble. It's the look I hold in my mind's eye when I need to feel peace and harmony and when I need to feel safe. What a gift. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Elena, about your book, about Brio and your relationship and what you learned from him.
Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Now a word from Richard Parker.
If you add them up, I guess I've spent nearly 40 of my years as a married man. But I'm currently in what I believe is the longest streak of unmarried years since I was old enough to vote. There are good things to be said about living with someone else, and good things to be said about living alone. As indicated, I currently do not have another person living with me, but it would be a mistake to say that I live alone. No, the minute you walk into my house, you're instantly aware of a large, dark presence checking to see if you might be carrying something in your hands. That would be Joby, my Doberman housemate, and he's wondering if you might be holding something edible. Joby is 6 years old, over 100 pounds of mainly muscle. He's the biggest Doberman my vet says she's ever seen. He got that way by eating me out of house and home. Well, almost. I buy dry food over $100 at a time and wet food to dump on top of it 10 large cans at a time. But I spend nearly as much money at Northern Star Mills as I do at Safeway. But Joby has to work for his dinner. He has his own treadmill, and he does 15 or 20 minutes on it most evenings before he gets his bowl. He doesn't seem to mind, but I suppose he wouldn't mind anything that he saw as a prelude to dinner. Joby is named after one of my favorite Gypsy King songs, Joby Joba. I know this couldn't help but lead to his becoming Joby the Doby, which I did not intend but couldn't help. Too cute for words. Well, sometimes he is too cute for words. I didn't know it before I had him and read up on the breed, but Dobermans are well known for refusing to grow up. Mentally, that is. He's considerably grown up physically, as mentioned, and he stands a little over 31 inches tall at the shoulder. I don't have to lean over to scratch his back. But just like I have trouble believing that I'm as old as my driver's license insists I am, Joby has a similar problem with his age. He is frisky to the point of imminent household damage, jumping about and rolling on the floor, snapping at the carpet like a crazy thing, but all in good fun. He's pretty smart and generally well-behaved. He understands a decent vocabulary for a dog, I guess, including some items that I insist on. For example, he had to learn to fall over on his side and lie still upon hearing the words, "dead dog." That way, he could answer my question when my friend Larry the lawyer comes to the house and I ask, "Joby, would you rather be a lawyer or a dead dog?" He responds by flopping over and lying still. This also works if my guest is an economist, a journalist, or a radio interviewer. No, Joby is a great comfort to me. Now that it's safe to build a fire, we build one in the living room stove and I pull up my chair and Joby curls up on a rug between chair and stove. It's the Parker boys at leisure, doing what they do best. Nothing at all. This is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Richard. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Elena Manis, author of Soul Dog. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.